Welcome to The Power of Stories, a podcast by women, about women, and for women. Their voices and their stories. I am Sharon Catherine D'Agostino, a passionate advocate for the empowerment of women and girls everywhere, and the founder of sayitforward.org.
And I'm Yodit Kifle-Smith, a creative dedicated to making sure the voices and stories of women are heard. I have the privilege of working with Sharon on sayitforward.org to do just that. In this podcast, you will meet courageous women from around the world whose unique path to empowerment will leave you encouraged and inspired. We are excited to welcome Dr. Suchi Gore. Suchi is the Director of Global Engagement and Impact at the World YWCA, a gold medalist for her PhD, and she was awarded a Fulbright scholarship for her doctoral work in participatory community communications. Suchi describes herself as a feminist who loves smashing patriarchy, an advocate for the rights of women and girls, and a stickler for diversity and inclusion. Welcome, Suchi.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Suchi, we're thrilled that you're here with us today. You made a big decision to move from India to Switzerland to accept a new job, and you describe that decision as liberating. How was it liberating?
In 2018 is when I moved to Geneva. But there's a whole background around it, you know, having been raised as a woman in India, not having lived a lot outside my house. I think the only time I moved was when I was on a Fulbright scholarship to New York. But other than that, I've been with family, lived in the house with parents. And then I got married in 2016 and we started living with our in-laws. So it was not a lot of change, you know, move from parents to in-laws, you're still with your parents. And then was doing a lot of interesting things in India when this opportunity to join World YWCA came in. And I was very excited. We went through all of the process. And in the middle of my paperwork getting done, I discovered that I was pregnant. And that was in itself like a big thing in India because it was my first child, A, but also being brought up in India, having a baby is a big thing for a woman. You know, whole family is there, all the women, young women are giving you suggestions on what to do, what not to do. And there I was. I mean, I didn't share the news with my family first. My husband knew and then my boss in Geneva knew because I said, well, think about it if you want to have me here. And she was more than elated and she was a big advocate. She got emotional and she said, well, this is what this movement is. You know, we are a feminist movement and being a pregnant woman is not going to stop us from having you here. And I was very excited. And when I shared it with my family, with larger family, everyone obviously had a very different approach to it because they were like, are you crazy? You know, you're thinking of moving abroad with when you're pregnant. This is the time you need support and family. Also, the initial plan was that because my husband was working in India, he'll stay in India and for some time. But when this news happened, everyone was like, what's your plan? Are you going to still move alone? And, you know, when the reality is as a woman, when all these doubts start pouring in, you start thinking about it and you're like, oh, should I do this? Should I not do this? And you go to whom? You go to your closest friends who know you, who understand you. My sisters who were very supportive with the whole idea, you know, they were worried. Obviously, they were concerned, but they were like, oh, we're sure you're going to do this. And so I spoke to one of my very close friends and she was like, what is your first reaction? I said, I still want to go. And she's like, yeah, that's your answer. Like, you know, you want to go. And somehow that was also a moment where I was like, oh, I'm pregnant. I'm entering this new stage in life. I really need to make this decision for my own self, for me and my husband as a family, but also for me as a woman, you know, who's going to raise a child. Do I want to do that in the system that I have lived in whole of my life, where I've been abused so many times, where I've been catcalled so many times, where the system is not safe, where you can't get out of your house after 7 p.m. alone? So I was mindful and I did take the jump. I leaped into moving to Geneva, lived alone during the initial months of pregnancy while my husband traveled back and forth. And I remember one of my friends in U.S., said that a woman can do three complicated things, you know, in life. One is a new job. you know, that's always doubt yourself because of how you're raised. Second is moving country, because moving to a new country is difficult. And third is entering motherhood. And you're doing all the three at the same time. And that's in itself so strong. And, you know, it didn't strike me till the time I did it. And when I reached here, I started doing everything one step by step. You know, I set up a house. I was full 7 months, 8 months pregnant, and I was traveling all around. And my husband joined me in the last phase, like when I was in my eighth month. He moved then. But I don't know. I mean, it was so liberating. I was working till the last day of my pregnancy. I also feel I was blessed enough to have a good health, you know, but I feel like that came from the fact that I was mentally, I had committed to myself that I have to make this happen. So that was my big move. And, you know, when you talk to people in Europe or you talk to my colleagues, I mean, sometimes I hear they don't see it that big a move, but as an Indian brown woman who knows how it is to be pregnant and how family plays a big role, I felt like that was that if I in my mind, I was very sure if I can do this, I can do anything. And that's the whole of it.
I love that. I love those words. If I can do that, I can do anything. So what advice do you have for other women who are facing decisions where other people think they should do one thing, but their heart is telling them that they want to do something else?
I think there are two things to it. One is like the gut, the inside of your core. You have to question yourself as to what you want to do, you know. And yes, you have to map the pros and cons. Will I have support? What do I need to do? That's like a legal pad in the back of your mind with the pros and cons list will happen. But I think in order to take that leap, you really have to just do it. I mean, honestly, if you do it, you also get a responsibility on yourself that I have to make it happen. The half of the time women struggle because they don't take that leap. And that's where the confidence lose and they feel like we can't do this. But the reality is anyone can do it. I know there are privileges to it. This in itself was a privilege I had. But if you can, if you have an option to do things, if you take that leap, there's a whole thought which comes with it that, oh, I have to make this happen. And even if it doesn't, I took the leap and I'm taking the learning out of it. So that part of maybe this is not going to happen, still I will do it, you know, is another important aspect of us, because we are so scared as women of failures, because we are conditioned to be scared of failures, that we are always worried about thinking about failures and not being okay with it as well. So I feel those two elements are very critical.
What was it like to think about yourself and to have that self-determination to say, this is something that I need to do, especially growing up in a culture where it almost feels very selfish to think about yourself?
Somehow, as women, we are trained to be good daughters, good mothers, good wives, good professionals, but we are not trained to be okay with our human self, you know, our needs, our desires, or every time we think of those things, we are labeled as being selfish. I feel for me, there was a point where I realized, so what, I'm being selfish? Like, because I was constantly questioning my own decision and I was asking to question it not from a negative space, but more from a space of, so what, now what will I do? I realized that if I don't do it, I'm going to regret it more. And that to me is where my self-care played in. And I was like, no, I have to do this because I don't want to live ahead my life thinking I had an opportunity. I was so privileged to even have an opportunity, you know, and not respecting that opportunity would have given me more regret than, you know, doing it and failing at it. I've seen women around me and they're miserable when they leave these opportunities. And do I want to be miserable? And as a human, even failure from this bigger size might make me feel capacitated to deal with failures.
Who listened to you when you were little? And did that, you know, how did that inspire you to do what you do now?
I come from a very privileged but very patriarchal historical family. From the area from where I come from, my ancestors come from, used to have one of the highest rate of female feticide. So you can see that there was a lot of concept of sun privilege and a concept of how that plays a very, very important role in carrying the lineage forward. It's a part of in North India. And I saw that in my family. Like I saw it in my both sides, but I still saw it in like high, playing high on radar. And I come from a set of parents who were self-made. Both my parents have built everything from scratch. They both have like 7 siblings on both sides. So very huge family. And yet my mother and my parents had 3 daughters. So we had 3 sisters. So a lot of my childhood went in figuring out why, as a young woman, my ancestrally, like in our circle, why is this constant questioning as to why we don't have a brother, you know? So there used to be a lot of thought around that, which used to come in. And as a young girl, I used to question it, but obviously you were clueless. As I started growing up, I used to question things like, why am I asked to wear this? Why can't I wear that? Or what is this about young girls eating later, or, you know, women eating later in the house? Why do women have to cover their heads? You know, why is that a sign of cultural respect to elders? And the good part was my parents were amazing with the way that they never stopped us from thinking about our careers, our kind of education we wanted. We all 3 sisters have pursued sciences and then have gone to become, have connected to the work of social development only. My elder sister is a professor in social services and communications and fundraising. And my younger sister is a counseling psychologist who works with adolescent children. So somewhere our careers are very aligned to the thought we have constantly driven. And I feel like over the years, as I transformed into a young woman, my college played a big role in it. You know, I was studying in a women's college, which was one of the oldest women's college in India. And we were trained a lot to question, you know, the patriarchal systems. And I brought all of that home. Sometimes it used to bring in disasters, obviously. You know, there was a lot of rebel moments we used to have. So much so when I thought of doing my PhD, a lot of my extended family members were like, why are you investing in her education? They were telling my dad that don't invest in her education, save it for her marriage, you know, because you have to give dowry, all that thought. And my dad used to be like, she has a scholarship, and if she wants to study, nothing stops her. And so there used to be those battles, and my parents helped a lot in fighting those. But there were also internal battles with them also, because they came from that mindset. For them, like pursuing a career in journalism meant, oh, you're going to come late at night. Oh, that crowd is not great. Or when I thought of joining my dad's business, my mother was like, no, it's not a career for women. So there were those internal battles, so much so that they almost thought that I'm going to get into this, I'm going to become a teacher or a professor. And I never did any of that. So when I thought of my PhD and I said, oh, I'm going to travel 4 countries as a part of my PhD, my parents freaked out, and my mother more so, you know, because she was like, oh, the whole family is extended family is going to question. And my dad was like, no, let her do this, you know, let's see. And one of the skills I learned as it just became a part of my life was negotiation, constant negotiation. And it was amazing. I negotiated my way to go for Fulbright scholarship as well, where I was telling my dad, people crave for this. I have this opportunity in hand. I'm not going to spend, like, let it go. So I think one big thing about all of this was, A, I always knew of my privilege. But B, I knew that if I have to make things happen, I have to negotiate with the circumstances. I have to constantly question, but I picked my battles. I knew where I have to fight and where I have to just let go, not fight, but be smart and cunning and get my way through my parents or my ex. And a lot of the learning happened with not giving the extended family or the community, larger community, the right to question me. And that came with a lot of support from my parents, but there were days when I used to be like, I don't care if you think I should not do it, because it's my life. And I think that's the model. I mean, I'm a middle child. So middle child children are known to be rebels. And that's somehow that my life has shaped up like that. And I say I pick my battles. I know which war to be fought and which war to be not. So, yeah.
So this point that you're making about negotiating being a skill and something that helped you do and convince others that you could do what you really wanted to do. Tell us how you negotiate.
I took up a profession in communications, in social work communications, because I felt I could talk to people and I could make them understand viewpoints. I remember I was on this exchange program in Michigan State University, and one of the persons said to me that they had my evaluation because I was doing this county work, extension work. And they wrote down that she can take any complicated subject and explain it very simply. And that was a reminder that I can take abstract concepts and negotiate my way with people to make things happen. And I feel one of the core skills that has helped me a lot is customization in marketing language. You know, I customize what people want to listen to and not what I'm trying to sell. So that in itself is a negotiation skill that has helped me a lot. I showcase them both good and bad futures. Like I put those pictures in front and then I leave the decisions on people. And obviously, sometimes it backfires, but that's where I say that I know exactly when do I have to negotiate, when do I have to fight. And when negotiations don't work out, I go to that next step of fighting. But, you know, I've worked in so many villages in Asia, in India, Nepal, Sri Lanka, in so many villages in North, you know, in East Coast, in US. And I think one skill that has helped me everywhere is this, that I speak for people. I speak what they want to listen to. Even when I'm talking about complicated concepts, like why they should not get, why a woman should not get ultrasound done and check if the baby is female or male and get abortion done because it's female, I try to play with her psychology, go in the back of questioning her as to why she's doing it. And then customizing my message. I don't say, oh, you should not do it, because that's not how psychology works. So I, by training also, and that skill I've taken into training also, because I'm a behavior change communication specialist. So negotiation is something which I always think every woman, young woman should learn.
I love that. I'm sure our listeners are taking notes for their... So, you know, with negotiation, I mean, you have a, how old is your daughter?
She's turning 2 this month. Yeah. Okay.
So how do you negotiate with her right now?
Yeah, that's another, I think I'm learning a whole lot of new things with her coming in my life. You know, yeah. When I look at her, I feel it's such a different life for her versus it was for me, because I call me and my sisters, we are the first generation feminists of the house. You know, my mother was, but she was not very vocal about her being. She was more, she would internalize. And we've been very vocal about our feminism. So for my daughter, Soha, it's going to be much easier, you know, that skill building, because she'll see it. She's constantly going to live through those things. She does it with us. Like, I'll give you an example. There are days when she'll make me angry, and when she'll see my face, she'll come and hug me and kiss me, and she knows that's a negotiation that will work with my mother. So somehow she's learning it already.
How can we all encourage other women and girls to confidently use their voice and claim their power?
I feel one of the core things that we shouldn't give to the new generation, to the generation now and generation of the future, which includes my daughter, is holding themselves, is stopping themselves from doing things. I think it's important to share stories, but when I share my stories, I put a disclaimer that this is just my journey and your journey might be completely different, and that take what you want to take from it, but don't restrict yourself there. I'm not going to tell her what she should be doing, my daughter, you know, what she should not be doing. I'll share my wisdom with her. And that's how we need to inspire the upcoming generation of taking wisdom out of it, not replicating stories again and again. You know, as a child, I used to learn, oh, we used to do it like this, so you should do it like that. And I'm like, no, that's not what I want to give my daughter. Do whatever you want to do, be good at it. Be a better, good human being. Be respectful, don't cheat, and be a better version of yourself every day. I didn't necessarily got that training, you know, in India. Not just from my mother. It's not just a job of parents to do. But as a culture, I didn't get that training. And I think as women, we need to start developing that culture where our coming generation, our young women, they just be what they want to be. And they just be good human beings. They carry the values. But in the name of values, we are not restricting them with cultures and traditions and religion and faith.
This conversation has been so encouraging. I know our listeners will take so much from it. So thank you so much, Suchi, for joining us today and sharing your wisdom, sharing your journey. And to our listeners, we want to thank you for making the time to listen to this episode of the Power of Stories podcast.
Suchi, I'd my thanks as well. I'm so moved by so many of the things that you said and the advice that you had for all of us, your advice to take the leap, your advice to be what you want to be. And I believe that's important advice, not just for young women, but for all of us, because at any point we can choose to be something new. So thank you so, so very much. And Yodit, thank you. I always love talking to you as well. And to our listeners, we invite you to visit sayitforward.org, a place where you are welcome to share one or more stories about your unique path to empowerment. Or you can read the stories of other women and girls. This is Sharon Catherine D'Agostino
and Yodit Kifle-Smith signing off for now and hoping you'll join us for our next episode of the Power of Stories podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, we do hope you'll give us a review and recommend the Power of Stories to a friend. And lastly, we want to remind you of the power of your story.